Strategic Christian Services is pleased to present the series Great Issues of Our Day. This is part four with Dennis Peacock.
So, question number three, what values will maximize both our freedoms and our unity? Theologically, what we call the one and the many, the balancing between the individual and the group. And as we said, that raises these issues of citizenship. What is freedom? What is freedom? One of the reasons that we started to transform is because we wanted a dialogue or an opportunity to speak to the world and raise questions that is not happening through the conventional media, or at least not in the way that we think it's most helpful. I'd love to see a month where, and maybe we'll do that on the transform.com, which again, I'm assuming all of you are aware of. And by the way, we're looking for writers. So those of you that want to write, and our next move is actually, just while I'm on that, is to start interviews with leaders, because we know a lot of leaders around the world where we'll do a kind of interviews that you're not going to get in most other places. And then next year, the plan is to start our reporters network. So numbers of you in here should be contributing to writing and certainly can do interviews in your area of specialization and give us a report on what's going on your part of the ranch, so to speak. What is freedom? Freedom is the ability to obey God. I'm going to say that again. It's a, I think, a pretty good definition. Freedom is the ability to obey God. You're not free where you can't obey God. Justice. What is justice? What is constitutionalism? Those of us that studied political theory, like my poor wife and I, when the constitutional movement began in the building of the modern nation states, the constitutions were viewed as the primary tool of establishing stability. I don't think there's much of a debate, if we actually got into it, that a number of things that are going on right now are unconstitutional in terms of the authority of civil government to do what it's doing. I'm waiting. One of the signs of the health of the body politic is going to be motion to review and redo the Constitution. That'll be interesting. We were just in a situation in Central America where the main event was term limits, and the current president decided that he wanted a constitutional amendment that would allow his term limit to be extended indefinitely. And your friend and mine, Hugo Chavez, was the one that was really pushing that to take place. And I wish I could tell you what I know about that, but it involves future action, so I can't. But the whole issue is the Constitution establishes the ground rules for what's possible and what isn't. We've already talked a little bit about transcendent values. What are the transcendent values of the United States of America? I have no clue at this point. I would imagine that political correctness, so that none of our inner child is hurt, is right up near the top. And I don't mean to really make as much fun of that as I sound. I believe in human dignity. I believe in human dignity because everybody's created in the image of God. I believe that human dignity is only based on that presupposition. Otherwise, we are nothing but the products of slime plus time, which gets us into a whole discussion about the role of evolution, which I've often said, if I had the faith that drives the evolutionists, I'd be into something. You know, the idea that given an infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters or computers and an infinite number of time, we'd type all the great literature stretches me a little. I do believe in actuarial studies. I do not believe in probability in that context. Diversity, there's a great discussion. I get, you know, after I teach a while, I got to be careful because I get dangerous. I can kill you many different ways. Which one do you want? It's diversity. You know, we can take many kinds of poison. Which one would you like? Criminal justice. How many of you besides me think that the decision to try the perpetrators of 911 in New York City is not a good idea? I am trying to figure out, where did that one come from? I think New York has already paid a very high price. Why would you subject them to, you know, well, let me just divert here. What's the name of the funny cartoon guy, Far Side? I know I'm in a room of strange people. I'm sorry?
Gary Larson.
Thank you. Gary Larson is not a well man, but he's a very funny man. And the thing that I love about Gary Gary Larson is he comes up with wonderfully zany things. And there's this one deer looking at the other deer, and one of the deers has got a bullseye birthmark, and he says, "Bummer of a birthmark, Bill," or whatever it is. Why in the world would you put a bullseye on New York City again? Haven't they paid enough? Oh, Lord. I guess I shouldn't have raised that myself. Yeah, it's not only a military issue, but why would you do that to the city? Why would you give a platform to the vitriol that is going to be loosed in that situation? It makes no sense to me. But once again,
the public venue exposes government operations and transactions during discovery, during that trial. And there's a motive there to bring things into the light that may not be driven by purity, if you know what I mean.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah, the comment was that the venue is going to bring things into the light, into the intelligence side of it, that won't be helpful. So again, I'm trying to give the powers that be the benefit of the doubt, but when those things happen, I just shake my head. Kingdom culture. Can I just say this, and this, you know, another way to even put a headline on what it is we're doing here, is we're here to talk about the difference between the culture of the world and the culture of the kingdom. That's really the bottom line, because all of this crisis is permitted by God, therefore has certainly secondary blessing to take us through the consequences of the value system that created this, so as to highlight the necessity of kingdom values. I think most of us in this room believe that if we were preaching the kingdom of God, things would be different than preaching the church. There's nowhere in the scripture we're told to preach the church. We are to preach the kingdom. And I personally think the thing that's going to come out of this that is going to be most exciting is people who begin to hear about the kingdom of God instead of the church. And I love the church and believe in the church, but the church is the executor on the earth of the kingdom. And we're not to be preaching ourselves. We preach the king and his kingdom. And that's going to be an exciting phenomenon. Political correctness, the media. I've already talked about immigration policy in the context of citizenship. Education. Where are people being educated in terms of these issues? Now, we can say homeschool, we can say Christian schools. Boy, I don't know if I want to get into all that. I'll just say that the homeschoolers have got a higher percentage, I'm sure, of people who are teaching these kinds of concepts and these kinds of questions. My experience with Christian school, and we started a number of our own Christian schools, so I'm not opposed to them by any means. And again, I have to say that I'm not current with a lot of what's being taught in Christian schools. But a lot of what was being taught in Christian schools is not biblical, I'll just say is not biblically based relative to the issues that we're talking about. You've got warmed up left, right, political presuppositions that are being taught rather than really looking and doing the harder work of digging into the scripture for a biblical view of a number of these things. Democratic pluralism. Do we believe in democratic pluralism? Yes, we do, because we believe in the power of choice. What does that pluralism look like? What does polytheism, what do those kinds of PC things mean? Well, we need to be able to say that God has established gravity, that the physical universe is run and maintained by laws that allow an orderly transition that God has created. And the same thing is true in the social realm. There are social realms, there are moral realms that have laws that are as immutable as the laws of the physical universe. And the consequences of breaking those laws have consequences. I believe in the respect for other people's religion. I don't believe that theology, or certainly the kinds of theological issues that divided the church politically, can be viably injected into the public conversation. But there are laws, and I would certainly begin with the Ten Commandments, which undergird all cultures and all societies. And those of you, and I'm not a Reconstructionist, but I love the fact that they deepen the conversation on multiple levels. Those of you that are interested in pursuing the political implications in terms of axiomatic laws, you need to read Rush Dooney's book on the Institutes of Biblical Law, which is about 1,000 pages, 1,054, but it's worth the journey. And I'd say that whether you're a critic of where all that goes, it's an education that everybody that's serious about this stuff needs to look at. Well, let's go to the last issue, number 4. Again, we're having to move for time. How do we create prosperity for the largest number of people? Now, I alluded to this problem. By the way, how many of you can see that these 6 questions are developing into a spine in which we can now categorize the news or categorize the discussion? I'm not an expert on epistemology, which again is a good 10-cent word that simply means the study of learning or the study of how we know what we know. What we do know about the human mind is that until the human mind is able to categorize a phenomena, it doesn't know what to do with it. The way God constructed our mind is like the phylums, if you want to use that language, relative to the animal kingdom, is the whole categorization. Now, where do we see that? That's the very first thing that Adam was given the assignment to do, was create phylums. He was to categorize the animals and give them a name. How many of you know that names have power? And that was the first assignment, was to begin to exercise the part of his mind which was able to identify and categorize the difference and the commonality between objects in the world. Now, an education, a good education, is designed to train all of us to see the commonality and the differences of things. And if we're going to change a nation or change people, you have to begin to define what are the categories where you put different phenomena. One of the great catastrophes of modern culture is the media, which does not train us to categorize phenomena. Hence, the general population is bombarded with a continuous stream of quote-unquote news, which they are never given or virtually never given the opportunity to slot where does this news fit. Because until you know where to make something fit, your mind is constructed by God in this manner. You are not able to assimilate information, and you're not able to create a hierarchy of values because you can't distinguish where something goes. Until you know where it goes, you can't categorize reality. until you know where it goes, you can't really begin a hierarchy of values. So the result is the massive dumbing down of the population base throughout the world, and especially as in the first world, which is why we keep having to revise the SAT exams, because the SAT exams of 30 years ago, we would continue to decrease. And if you're spending billions of dollars on education, you can't have failing tests. So what you do is you just keep lowering the bar so that you can justify the expenditures. The reason that we have put all these bullet points is we are in the process of trying to both comprehend and educate other people as to what the categories are of news, so that we can take virtually whatever you want to talk about it and put it into one of these slots. Now, the folks that are listening to this, and I need to decide and I need more counsel on this, what you don't know is that behind the transform is this sheet. And this sheet has all six of the questions, and it has all the axioms that we have now identified that are the main concepts that have to be dealt with in each one of these issues. Now, who gets this and what we do with this? Although on the transform, we try and faithfully put the axiom that is involved in the analysis of the article, we try and put that on. What we do with this, and again, this is a work in process, is something that we want to, we're trying to figure out. Now, I'll just give you, for example, and I said this relative to number four. The right is concerned with creating prosperity. The left is concerned with the largest number of people. Until we bring those two issues together, we're not going to have a kingdom view of economics. I said that I speak in tongues or mumble in tongues and, again, fumble with where is this giant bong in D.C. so we can tell people to stay away from it. I was listening to George Bush, which it's amazing to me how quiet he's been. Maybe a gift. But I was listening to him a couple of years ago as he was trying to explain cutting taxes. And I kept saying, and come on, do it. You can do it. Come on, you can do it. You can. I know you can do it. Will you please connect taxation policy with capital creation? It didn't happen. I have never heard one single edifying conversation about the relationship between taxation policy and capital creation. I mean, I'm sure that there has been. I'm just saying, and I've watched a lot of news, I've never heard that conversation. How in God's name can we have a political climate where the most fundamental of all questions is not discussed, which is, what is capital? How is it created? And how is it related to economic growth? It is not possible to have an enlightened citizenry, let alone a Congress that has any real concept of what it's doing without that conversation. And again, I alluded to that when I said every government job, while it creates employment, is a transfer of the wealth of the people to create that job, which does not create capital, because by definition, government jobs do not produce profit. And profit is where capital comes from. And anything that stimulates profit, and again, put this in the context of the creation of capital creates responsibilities for those who create it. Everybody said, amen. Okay? That taxation policy is directly related to the stimulation of incentive to create capital. So in the long term, if you want as maximum employment, your policies are going to be geared to not only stimulate the creation of capital, Your taxation policies are going to be geared to stimulate investment into training people for new jobs. Now, I don't know what part of that you don't understand. I know that Washington, D.C. obviously does not understand that. Because if they did, I'm sure there's smart people that do. But why is that not in the public conversation? How can that be? How can that be? But it is. So the question is, how do we create prosperity for the largest number of people? Capital creation, trades and tariffs, currency, unions, micro-enterprise. Boy, I wish we could get into this. The IMF, that's not INF, it should be IMF, World Bank. How many of you know the third world is squeezed? Oh, I could tell you stories. I could tell you stories. I know of a situation personally where the United States overthrew a country because this country's leaders did not want to get more entwined in the IMF and in the financial system. And that was a real broken heart situation for me. I love America, but when America does that stuff, that's painful. Banking. You know, I said this somewhere. What I'm believing to do in the next year or so is begin to hold summits and seminars with bankers and economists, because we've got to start working on our plans now. So those of you that you think you know somebody who's qualified to sit in those kinds of discussions, please contact me at the office. Mammon. How many of you familiar with Earl Pitts? How many of you are sorry you're familiar with Earl Pitts? Earl Pitts is the master of Mammon. He's got more insight on Mammon than anybody I know. And that's, again, basic economics 1A, that for us as believers, if we're going to get into economics and all this stuff, we have to be clear on Mammon. The nature of poverty cannot be resolved by money. Many, many things we could say about that. Entitlements, monetary policy, keep those presses rolling. You know what's funny about this? Relative to conventional economics, those of us that were trained in conventional economics, everybody knows that all of this currency that's not backed by real productivity is going to create inflation. The only problem is now there's a debate whether or not it's going to create deflation instead of inflation, because a lot of the rules that we thought applied, we're not sure anymore what applies. Or when does it apply? You know, what time period kicks in this phenomena? Because hypothetically, the amount of currency that's been added without the creation of wealth, the inflationary pressure should be coming fairly acute by this point in time, but it isn't. Now, again, I know there's artificial reasons why it is not. But some months ago, you know, I felt in wrestling with this stuff before the Lord, I felt the Lord assure me that conventional wisdom as we know it, some of it's going to go by the wayside, because there's factors involved that are wild cards at this point. Balance of trade. President is in China talking about balance of trade issues. Again, a lot of things. Business law, health care, debt, division of labor. How about the difference between charity and investments? How many of you besides me are relatively clear that the Bible talks about two different kinds of financial engagements with people? You invest in people, and if you invest, you expect a return and the consequences of and stimulation to get a return is a biblical concept. Whereas charity, you do not expect a return. We are not clear on that in the United States. You know, we've confused in a lot of our policy what should be flat-out charity and other situations which should be investment, which require responsibility from both sides, both in terms of training people how to make a return and the assumption of the recipient that they need to create a return. Now, let me just give you some of the axioms that we have seen as we are looking at this particular question. Godly economics, I'm reading here from my master cheat sheet. In the office, I'm infamous for creating 11 by 17 inch diagrams. Godly economics is about the system's commitment to justice, empowerment, and generational growth. Now, again, that's a very carefully worded phrase. Godly economics is about the system's commitment to justice, that is, everybody receiving their due, what is due to them, empowerment, which means that the economy is maximizing the principle of empowerment more than it's maximizing profit. Because profit is a fruit, not a goal. Those of you that are in the business school, those of you that have read Doing Business God's Way, you remember I make a big issue out of that. The problem with capitalism is it's made profit the primary goal. The primary goal should be the empowerment of the people participating in the system. If that's the goal, then you're going to produce more profit than you will if your goal is profit, because you're empowering more people. You're not empowering fewer people, you're empowering more people. Because you can create short-run profit by focusing on a few people instead of producing maximized profit over a period of time by focusing on a larger number of people, which is why the question is, how do we produce prosperity for the largest number of people? So we're committed to empowerment and generational growth. That means that we're not pushing burdens on the future generations, and we're not stealing from current generations parentally. We are maximizing generational growth. Second principle, responsible personal choice. Here's a world of economics in this statement. Responsible personal choice is the greatest market incentive. There's a book in that statement relative to economics. Responsible personal choice is the greatest market incentive. If you want an economy to grow, the Urim and Thummim, the principle that you're looking at here among these others, is how do we maximize personal choice? Because personal choice is the greatest stimulant that an individual has. You take away personal choice, they will obey, but they will not enthusiastically obey because they do not perceive their will being involved in the situation. Number three, good stewardship and responsibility prepares us for growth. Again, that's one of the 12 axioms that we have in Doing Business God's Way. The great economic principle of this is Matthew 13:12, which is the most regressive, and I use that word advisedly in an economic sense, as in the most unfair from the world's point of view. The most unfair comment that Jesus ever could have made was Matthew 13:12. And that is, he who has gets more, and he who doesn't have even what he has gets taken away. Now, that's reverse Robin Hood. That's stealing from the poor and giving to the rich. What did Jesus mean when he said it? What he is saying is, because stewardship is such a major principle of responsibility in the scripture, he's saying, if you're irresponsible, don't expect more, expect less. All prosperity that is lasting is measured by the stewardship of what you now have. If you want a better car, take care of the car that you have now. If you want more, become a better steward of what you have now. And obviously, when we talk about fireproofing our lives and our businesses, that's going to be something we talk about. Number four, the economy rests upon the faith of the people in the system. The faith of the people in the economic system in this country right now is at an all-time low since the early 1930s, and it has not bottomed out. The single most important economic indicator is the faith of people in the system. It's not housing starts. It's not the stock market. It's not ROIs on companies. The single most important indication of what's really going on is the faith of people in the system. Now, it shows up in different places and ways, but nevertheless, when you hear consumer confidence reports, pay attention to those. Number five, the market system must be accountable. And I was talking about this. What part of the market policing itself don't they understand? And I would say almost all of it they don't understand. If the market system does not police itself, God will make sure civil government polices it. And then the market system complains about government interference. Well, you dodos, you know, read it and weep. You're going to get that if you're not responsible. Number six, good government helps produce prosperity. You can measure good government by, is it producing prosperity in the people? Number seven, legitimate capital creation through profit is the surest way to full employment and prosperity. John Maynard Keynes's system, by his own confession, the thing that he cared most about, the highest goal, was full employment, and lots of mechanisms whereby he was going to get to full employment. Well, we need to talk about what is the best way to full employment. That's capital creation through profit, not through artificial stimulation through the civil government. Eight, this is a beauty. I've challenged people all over the world, still haven't found a country yet that wants to take me up on this thing. Taxation should be flat so as to honor everyone's citizenship equally. God is a flat taxer. Now, all of us who were trained in economics, we all know that a flat tax is a regressive tax. You want a progressive tax on the assumption you should tax the wealthy more than the poor. You know, the first thing that does is it disenfranchises the honor of the poor. Now, I don't know how many of you are aware of this. Some of you are aware of this. More than 40% of the American population right now pays no income tax. So why, this goes back into the evil party and the stupid party. Why in the world are the Republicans so excited about cutting taxes when they're talking to the general population? Because 40% of them don't even pay taxes. What part of that don't you get? Especially because elections are won by margins of 2 or 3%. Why would you bring an issue that is so marginal to people? I mean, the people that are already committed to lower taxes are committed to lower taxes. That makes no sense at all as a political strategy to talk about cutting taxes, because you've already got the people in your pocket that want to cut taxes. 40% of the population doesn't care because they're not going to be gaining anything by you cutting their taxes because they don't pay any. So what is the psychological devaluation of me not paying taxes? It means that somebody else is carrying my weight, and I'm saying they should be. I've never heard this discussed publicly. Again, I can't understand it. The Bible, in the flat tax of 10% tithe, honors the poor to exactly the same degree as it honors the rich. We have no idea the disenfranchisement that progressive taxation has done to the lower classes, so to speak, in this country. It does not allow them, it does not afford them the dignity of saying to the rich, hey, I'm paying as much percentage as my income as you are. Don't treat me like some peon or some idiot. I've got as much of a stakehold in this thing relative to what I have as you do. I'm going to save that for questions, okay? So not only is a flat tax the biblical model, it's not just a biblical model for eliminating games, fun and games. How many of you know taxation avoidance is the great fun and games exercise of many lawyers? If we were going to have a biblical taxation policy. It would be flat, and there would be no exemptions. There would be no games. And we would be releasing not only billions and billions and billions of dollars relative to capital gains production, we would be saving incredible amounts of energy and time in tax avoidance stimulation. Now, again, the liberals, and liberalism is not a bad thing, liberalism certainly in its historical sense was a very positive thing. I hope you're aware that liberalism in the 19th century did not mean what it ended up at the end of the 20th century. It didn't mean left. It meant the liberation of people. That's what the liberal movement was about initially. So, number 9, government employment does not directly produce capital, but taxation obligations. Number 10, money cannot fix poverty, since poverty is the result of systemic injustice, a lack of skill sets, poor stewardship, or character issues. That's an axiom. Number 11, you can't guarantee as a right what cannot be paid for without new debt. There's a novel idea. You cannot guarantee as a right what cannot be paid for without creating new debt. Now, again, I've got more that go on this column, but I'm just trying to give you a sample of what it is that we're trying to do, because what we want to advance in the conversation is what would be a kingdom point of view? What would be a biblically based, or if we're going to be a little jukey here and a little jujitsu-y, what would be ancient wisdom's contribution? And that's a phrase that you can use, and you know, somebody will say, well, gee, what is that? Well, that's the scriptures, ancient wisdom. What's ancient wisdom analysis of cause and effect relative to these situations? Well, we are running out of time, so what I want to do right now is open up about 10 or 15 minutes of comments. And in the rear, you had a...
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is basically centered around how do we solve this? We, knowing that racism is a modern-day construct, that it was because of the love of money, which is the root of all evil, that in ancient days there weren't the history of racism. It was a modern-day economic construct because, again, we looked at people of color and we were able to exploit them for labor. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at that as a modern-day construct, how do we eradicate that principle in the sense that I'm looking at today, here we are, we have a new slaveocracy. Mm-hmm. Here's the African-American male, maybe 7% of the population, but over 70% of the prisons are filled up with primarily African-American, mm-hmm. Latino people. Mm-hmm. And those people are literally being used just like they were 250 years ago because of slave labor. They're actually producing in the penal system. They're actually utilizing their bodies to produce profit. Mm-hmm. And so when we're dealing on in the inner city and on the level where the majority of African Americans are at, I understand that the poverty is not due to money, but I'm looking at Zacchaeus and what happened with Jesus dealt with him. Here was somebody who gained money through the exploitation of the poor, and when justice came, Zacchaeus said, hey, I will give back half of what I own, and mm-hmm. anybody that I personally dealt with, I'll give them four times the amount. So when I look at the masses of people and I look at the poverty, and the number one thing right now is a lack of jobs.
Yes.
Is that how can a person be the priest, the protector, the provider? How can we get back to the values that is totally bankrupt with the marginalized? And we don't address the issue, and you said it, on not just on American level, but on a global scale, where the rich are literally getting richer, the poor are getting mm-hmm. poorer. Because of the exploitation of labor. You know, how do we get to the point where, you know, yes, in order for me to get values, a man has to have the right to be able to earn the living, and that is being eradicated. So it's like, how do we deal with that on a real issue level? How do we deal with the injustice of poverty and the lack of jobs? And saying, okay, if I'm going to speak truth to power, mm-hmm. then I'm going to have to be like Zacchaeus. I'm going to have to literally give up and build this infrastructure from the bottom up, mm-hmm. starting with the right man to be able to earn a proper living, just like it says in James. I could talk about spiritual values all day long, but if I do not give that person the ability to be able to be, again, the priest, protector, provider, I'm not dealing with those real social needs, which are really values, mm-hmm. Because like, there's a book that was written by a famous New York editor, The White Man's Burden. Mm-hmm. Literally around the world, through the IMF and the World Bank, they have totally devalued, you know, the masses of people. And I'm just wondering how to be addressed.
Well, again, that's in the heart of a lot of what a lot of us care about a bunch. When all else fails, go to the Scripture. I say tongue in cheek. And again, that God help the church, because so many of the people that handle the Word of God obviously do not understand that we have a whole Bible, and that while the Old Testament and the law is finished as a salvation issue, the principles in the Old Testament are valid. So how did the Old Testament deal with poverty in Israel? The principle was voluntary in servitude, which, hear all this out, because we're looking at the principle, not the lawful application in the Old Testament. The way you leverage people out of poverty is by connecting them with wealth producers. Discipleship. They, as you know, because I hear the Bible coming out of you a bunch, as you know, they made a 7-year contract where it was very clear what they went in with and what they came out from. Now, they weren't stupid. Their job was to find the most productive person they could find to enter that contract with, the person who clearly and obviously had the skill sets of producing wealth, because the purpose was not going there to be, yes, a massa. The purpose of that relationship was, you have an implicit obligation for me to serve you, but in the serving you is for you to train me so that I'm apprenticed, as it were, with the wealth-producing skills you have. Now, however we adapt that model is the only real biblical solution to poverty. Now, we can do it through taxation incentive, where we give tax credits to individuals or businesses that adopt the discipling model. But God's answer to the alleviation of poverty is the responsibility of empowering people with the skills that produce capital. Now, in the so-called third world, in some of the places that we've worked and supported, we engage in microenterprise and apply that. And the way it's done is you get capital. First of all, you come with a business plan, and we'll help you develop that business plan because we want you to succeed. Now, by the way, this gets into the banking system as well. It means that the banks can no longer be primarily trying to make money through interest. It means that we have to go back to a banking system, or at least numbers of banks that were like the mercantile banking system, where the bank had a sunset clause with the loan, as in, we will use the resources of this bank to make you successful. We'll take X percentage of the profit for X years because our goal is to empower you to make this business succeed. We're not interested in collecting interest with you. We're interested in being a partner with you in helping to produce profit. And when you've paid us back in profit, which now we have a mutual stimulation to make this thing succeed. Now, obviously, banks don't want to make bad loans, but their incentive is to make a good loan rather than their incentive being to empower somebody that they loan. Not just by giving them money and letting that be the end of the obligation, but the obligation is we're going to give you the skill sets because we want to partner with you in, again, the discipling of you in the creation of capital. So the whole foundation of the discussion has got to shift from giving money is to how are we going to connect you and how we connect the business community in such a way that they see they have an enlightened responsibility to make sure that there are the least number of poor people in the culture. Because it's a drain to everybody. It's a disaster for the poor, but in the long run, it's a disaster for the wealthy as well. So the answer is through discipleship. Now, again, the whole issue relative to the absentee fatherism thing, that's a tough one. Because as you know, and again, if I know you, forgive me, I don't remember that I've met you, but if it's clear that, you know, you're into the stuff. As you know, it was the Great Society program that accelerated the absentee black man in the American family. I mean, all we did was throw gasoline on a problem and multiply it by a ton by supporting women to get pregnant outside of wedlock. So there's got to be an incentive to stimulate the male to get back involved in that family. And there's numbers of ways that we can talk about doing that, but those are the two things we have to do. We have to connect the responsibility of the capital producers to empower the skill sets of those who don't have it, and we need to incentivize the male to be an abiding, long-term relationship with the female in the family unit. And again, that's got to be the spine from which all of our discussions and adaptations flow out of those principles, and we're back to axioms and corollaries.
Yeah. Teasing out the biblical concept of the year of Jubilee, where again the land was taken, and then at the end of 50 years it was given back. I think that would be a start. And the other thing would be almost, again, let's eliminate the Great Society blunder. It was only supposed to be on welfare for a number of years. It's gone for over two decades now, close to 40 years. And why can't we get back to the point? I looked at what they did during the 30s. When FDR came in, he came up with civilian, the conservative civilian corps, where literally you had a mass amount of primary men, black, white, and Latino, unemployed, and they gave them jobs. And again, they gave them the meaning to be able to be, again, the priests, protectors of the families.
Yeah.
And said, well, let's take these stimulus monies instead of bailing out Wall Street, again, put it back into job creation, and again, we can get a foundation to go ahead and have them out.
Well, we're back to the bong in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You know, what planet are these people on? Go ahead. I'm with you.
This is kind of the same word, Dennis. Let me assert this and then have you comment on it, right? In this way, for me to be brief. My responsibility to tithe as a disciple is not the same and is not equal to my responsibility to pay taxes to my government, which are God's ministers to ensure a level fee about it. And so when I hear the discussion about a percentage of flat tax, it moves past some of the limits or boundary conditions that you were referring to earlier, which is 10% of my income may not be exactly equal to 10% of your income or anybody else's in this room.
It won't be.
But the cost of government for each one of us should, in effect, be the same, dollar for dollar. There should not be a difference in the level of service that I get from my government that you get. Right? And so really we're talking about dollars, not percentages.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cost of government per citizen? What is equal fair share for each citizen that is payable? And does that then not define the limits of what the government can, again, based on their ability to consume revenues from us, wouldn't that mean that when they're making deliberations about what other monies to spend, they would have to look at, we're either going to have to raise revenues to cover that, or we're going to have to cover it with debt, right?
Yeah.
So that's really my assertion. I would prefer that we not talk about a flat tax in terms of percentages to the government, but in real dollar terms of cost per government per citizen.
Yeah, I understand why you're saying what you're saying. I have no clue as to how, in the complexity of where we are, how we would come up with a figure that would deal with the cost of government per person. I mean, that would be, I'd love to, you know, now not on live time on this discussion right now, I'd love to know how you would go about figuring that out. I'm not saying that there's not some validity in what you're saying. I don't know how you'd figure it out. The reason that I brought up flat tax is really threefold. Number one, it's biblical. And all of us were trained in progressive taxation. It's an absolute mandate for so-called social justice relative to economics that you have to have progressive taxation or you're shafting the poor, so to speak. And the second issue is I'm saying you're shafting the poor with it because you're making them a lesser citizen in terms of the dignity of their commitment of their equal share of their revenue to the rich, which I think has got a greater bearing than we've looked at. And thirdly, a flat tax is going to accelerate the creation of capital faster than anything we can do, because it's going to eliminate all the games. I mean, my poor wife, you know, I'm the macro and she's the micro, and she gets, you know, she's had the end of dealing with the taxation, this and that and the other, you know, and she's a smart lady. And when she goes through all the loopholes and all the games, I don't even want to hear about it, because all it does is make me angry that once again you establish whatever the taxes are, and the moment they're established, you've got all the people in power who are circumventing them, and all this wasted capital and time and energy that is spent in evasion or minimization. It's an incredibly non-productive and unrighteous practice. And if you had a flat tax, you're eliminating something that God opposes, which is another way of saying God opposes that which is not productive. I want to say one more thing about this, and I'm not far enough down the road in my thinking on this. I feel like the Lord is beginning to open this up to me. But it's becoming absolutely apparent to me that part of what's wrong with the system is not just the leverage issue, because there's got to be regulation on the degree of leverage. I know there is on bank loans, you know, in terms of amount of reserves, but the leverage has got totally out of hand in terms of responsible financing, and you understand what I'm saying. But like in the dot-com crisis, as I watched all that take place and these incredible values being given to companies based on potential, you had value being created with no actual capital being created. And as I'm beginning to watch, and I got to get back, you know, I need some time to find whatever studies have been done. But my strong suspicion is, because God is the God of the economy, because it's related to labor, and God cares a ton about labor and justice in labor, which we talked about here briefly. I'm coming to the conclusion that one of the main reasons why we had this latest adjustment is just square two of the dot-com issue, which was the housing issue, is where there's an artificial capital that is created when no productivity is actually legitimized that creation. God gets involved and defunds what just took place. Now, if what I'm saying is true, and I'm almost there in ink, I go from light pencil, heavy pencil, I'm almost there in ink, then that is going to be one of the major adjustments that goes into this economic reset, is the speculation is going to be significantly reduced on betting on the come, because God does not honor betting on the come, because it's artificial increase in capital with no real substantial value that's being created. And what we need to have is an economy that is looking on genuine value rather than a bubble which has been artificially created for the sake of a small set of people who are using the system to make money off that bubble. And we need to have that discussion. We need to have that discussion. It may be going on, but I haven't heard it.
I don't think it is, and I agree with my friend over here. You know, it is the key to the kingdom in a lot of ways. When we really start digging into these issues, it is the key to the kingdom. I'd love to have the discussion. I'll stop because I know we got.
Yeah, and this is why we need, you know, and I'm just saying this publicly, and I hope I'm not being more stupid than usual. But I've started collecting articles from economists, and I have no idea whether they're saved or not, and right now I don't care. Is I'm looking for the smartest people that I can see who are contributing to the conversation. And what I want to see is some summits begin to happen, because if we don't build an ark, if we do not build an ark in the midst of this situation, you know, we flunk, you know, math 1A. We flunk righteousness 1A. We're even more foolish than I think we are. Okay, let's go to one more comment.
What skill sets would you say produce capital?
What
are the most valuable?
What are the most valuable skill sets to produce capital? Strategic thinking would go right to the very top of the list. Great question. The ability to, again, follow what Jesus taught in Luke 15 about you can't be my disciple if you've not got your relationship squared away. You can't be my disciple if you've not counted the cost. You can't be my disciple if you've not done an resource analysis in the context of warfare or the challenges that will come against what you're doing. You can't be my disciple unless you pick up your cross daily. And those kinds of thought processes, building your house on a rock rather than on the sand, that's all about the investment that you put into the foundations of what you're doing. In the multitude of counsel, there's safety. And now we're back to the responsibility of the experienced to empower the less experienced. So again, we could make a fairly long list of things, and that's a great question. But those are things that come to the top of my head.
This is a copyrighted program of Strategic Christian Services, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Strategic Christian Services offers a wide variety of other educational materials and training schools designed to help you live life to its fullest. For more information on our products and services, please call us at 1-800-700-0605. Join us online at www.gostrategic.org or write to us at Post Office Box 2709, Santa Rosa, California 95405.